It was 1851, and the great Unitarian minister Theodore Parker decided that he needed a gun. "I have been obliged to arm myself," he told the gathering of the Assembly of Unitarian Ministers that May. He says, "I have written sermons with a pistol in my desk, loaded and ready for action." The 1850s, those of you who are familiar with U.S. history, you kind of think your way back. That was a tumultuous time for our country, a time of stark division, a time where, of course, whatever it was to be black was to be endangered, but also a time where white people were waking up, or at least some white people were realizing they could no longer simply stay silent in the face of slavery. This was the reason for the Fugitive Slave Act, which was enacted in 1850. It was an attempt to try to stop these shifting sands. It was a law meant to force the North to cooperate actively with slavery. It made it illegal for someone to know about an escaped slave and yet fail to ensure their return. I started to think about this and imagine that it would be not too different today if there was a law made where if any one of us knew about someone who was undocumented, that it would become illegal and punishable by fines and jail time if we did not actively ensure their detention. It is a terrible moral dilemma, and also my imagining was extra terrible because it wasn't an impossibility in my mind. Northerners who had it before simply tried not to think about slavery. They were forced to kind of figure out truly what did they think, to decide officially what side they were on. Would they risk their own security and freedom, or more explicitly cooperate with what most knew by then was an evil practice with generational consequences? For many, they felt this Fugitive Slave Act was like their worst nightmare. And also, as we know, sometimes the worst thing can become the beginnings of real change. Theodore Parker's activism, it was already in full force long before the 1850s. He had spent his life on the leading edge of religious, moral, and social transformation. He's the one that said, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one, but from what I can see, it bends towards justice." That quote, in turn, then was picked up by Martin Luther King, which was then picked up by Barack Obama. That was his original quote, Parker. He was kind of an anomaly for his time in that he had what I think many consider the first like mega congregation. He preached in Boston to a congregation every Sunday of about 2,000, which for the time, 1850, that was very large. It was also in 1850 an integrated congregation. So in the congregation, there were both black free men and also fugitive slaves. There was no way that Theodore Parker was going to comply with the Fugitive Slave Act. It would be completely contrary to everything that he believed in and had worked for, and it certainly would mean failing to do his part in bending that moral arc. So instead, he opened his home to fugitive slaves and protected them, all while continuing to preach from his pulpit about abolition, which is why he had been, as he said, obliged to arm himself, keeping a gun in his desk at the ready. I wonder what it felt like for him to write his sermons with the gun right there, imagining his congregation coming in on Sunday, but his gun is right there. How this gun shifted his sense of urgency, how it clarified or maybe challenged his commitment, how it changed him, his faith, his life. There was nothing abstract about the risk of his ministry. I mean, it was like right there, tangible, intentional, clearly life-threatening. This is the power of a gun. That is, a gun is never actually only about the gun. The gun is also about power itself, but also shame, ego, fear, control, pain. A gun is an act of performance or sport sometimes, survival, sometimes rage. When we talk about guns, we are not just talking about guns. We are talking also often about poverty, about class, about capitalism, about racism, about domestic violence, patriarchy, mental illness, health care. We are talking about children and parents and elders and communities. We are talking about our country and our understandings of ourselves. When we are talking about guns, we are talking about us. There are more than 350 million guns currently in circulation in the U.S. alone. That means about 120 guns for every 100 people. 120 guns for every 100 people. On the average, on an average day, 96 people in the U.S. are killed by guns. Every week, 136 children and teenagers are shot. Every week. More than 30 Americans are murdered by a gun every day, and 15 of those 30 are black men. More than 135,000 students in the U.S. have lived through a school shooting in the last 20 years. More than 135,000 students have lived through a school shooting. That means since Columbine. Mass shootings are not, as I think many of us know, actually the biggest threat from guns. Suicide is. Having access to a gun makes it that just so much more likely that someone who might be just kind of thinking about it, considering, struggling, will actually complete suicide. These numbers, this reality, it is both astounding and also not completely surprising. The American idea, after all, is caught up in guns and gun violence. Charles Blow summarizes in the New York Times, "It is by the barrel that this land was acquired, and it is by the barrel that the slave was subdued and his rebellion squashed." And that is to say nothing of its wars. Violence is a deeply embedded part of our cultural identity. We live in a culture permeated by guns. They are everywhere, so much they can start to be invisible. You don't even notice, oh, that security guard has a couple. That person on the way into the mall has one. Guns start to be kind of assumed, like as if a part of the natural order. And at least if you talk to the so-called Second Amendment people today, that is how they think about the individual's right to own a gun, as if it is a part of the natural order, a human right, or at least a right clearly authorized by the U.S. Constitution as it was originally written by James Madison. The story of the Second Amendment, however, is much more complicated than this, in that it has not always been all this clear-cut. Even it hasn't even been this consensus, even amongst conservatives, that this amendment was intended to secure an individual right to bear arms. I'm going to start, in case you don't have it memorized, let's just review the Second Amendment, what it actually says. It is grammatically fascinating and complicated, and if you ever want to get really nerdy about this subject, you can go find the Supreme Court transcripts where they talk about this amendment and they argue for a very long time about the grammar. It goes, "A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed." The debate was mostly, as you can tell, about the commas. Now, growing up, like I'm sure many of you, I learned about this amendment in school. I, along with all the other ones, the Second Amendment lesson was kind of like, well, that was written when we were a new country and we needed a militia, so it's pretty antiquated. We keep it around because we don't want to mess up the numbers, but basically it doesn't apply. Now, if you were in school in the 1980s or earlier, you probably got a similar lesson. But that is not how we understand or talk about the Second Amendment today. Today, this amendment actually has nothing to do with some antiquated idea of the militia, everything to do with the right for an individual to own a gun. Now, to explain this shift, we have to start with a little trivia. Are you ready? Okay, my question, my trivia question for you. What new governor of California in 1967 said these words? Ready? There is absolutely no reason why out on a street today a civilian should be carrying a loaded weapon. Yeah, those are Reagan's words in 1967. I'm going to read them again just so you can kind of put those two images in your mind. There is absolutely no reason why out on a street today a civilian should be carrying a loaded weapon. Okay, one more trivia question. What candidate for president, the first presidential candidate endorsed by the NRA, by the way, said in 1980, quote, "The Constitution says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Also, Ronald Reagan. It is not a coincidence that Reagan's shift in thinking parallels the shift in the wider U.S. in those same years, because that shift actually started in the context of the statement that he made in 1967. Reagan, it turns out, was actually at the forefront of U.S. gun control efforts because he specifically wanted to stop the carrying of guns of the newly formed Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, not to be confused with nor entirely separated from the Black Panther comic and movie franchise, was a political political organization founded by Bobby Seale and Huey Newton in 1966 with an intention to monitor and hold accountable the Oakland Police Department. Their phrase was to police the police. So Newton, he was a law student, so he'd studied the Second Amendment along with California state law, and also he was brilliant. And so he figured out that actually there was no legal reason that they could not show up in public, for example, in front of the state house as they were deciding about gun control laws with shotguns, which is what they did. Newton and Seale and 28 other members of the Black Panther Party, mostly men, lined up at the state house in Sacramento with 24 loaded guns, 357 magnums, 12-gauge shotguns, 45 caliber pistols, which if all of that sounds like gibbledygook to you, they're like giant guns. Shortly thereafter, Reagan was all, "There is absolutely no reason why out on a street today a civilian should be carrying a loaded weapon." And some of the first gun control laws in the country were passed in California with bipartisan support, making it illegal to carry loaded weapons in public, because guns are never just about guns. Guns are about power. Who has it, who doesn't, who hopes to gain power. And guns are about the story we tell ourselves about that power. It's righteousness or not. The holder of the gun is the protagonist, the hero, or else they are the villain and the criminal. And the black men lining up holding shotguns at the state capitol, even if they are doing nothing more than standing and watching, we know what role the American idea would cast them in. On the other hand, while the state legislature was busy writing these gun laws to prevent black men from turning up in public with shotguns, white folks who had some guns were paying attention. So whether or not these laws were intended for them, they took it as a threat and they started mobilizing. It was this generation of white gun owners that were the ones that were responsible for transforming the NRA from the kind of training, safety, and hunting organization that at least some of you have a memory of it, that's what it used to be. But this generation, they're the ones that were responsible for then, sometimes people use the word hijack, but you could also say leading the NRA to becoming what it is today, that is the unquestioned leader in the fight against gun control. During the 2016 campaign season, the NRA spent about $419 million on lobbying. Colorado Senator Gardner received nearly $4 million of that. There was a time, I remember it, when Colorado seemed to be the best hope for new leadership in the conversation around guns. We have every reason, every heartbreak to fuel bold and courageous leadership. Next April will mark the 20-year anniversary of the day two high school students in Littleton opened fire on their fellow students and teachers, killing 12 and injuring 21 others and taking their own lives. I don't know if any of you, like me, have personal connections to people who were there on that day or pretty close, but what I know for sure is that on that day, everything changed. For everyone there, no student, no teacher, no staff, no one went on to live the life they thought they were going to live. Everything changed, or at least for a few moments we thought it did. There was outrage and dialogue spreading across the country, passionate calls for accountability and change. The oldest and largest gun maker in the U.S., Smith & Wesson, they announced that they would implement child safety triggers, develop smart guns, and a better system for background checks and other screening. We cheered, and then the NRA went to work, the new version of the NRA, with boycotts and blackouts and PR campaigns, and within a year, Smith & Wesson folded. The NRA, however, was just stronger than ever. So really nothing changed, except that we started to learn the pattern where we brace ourselves, we learned to brace ourselves for the next one, which would come too soon. Now, like many white women who grew up in small towns, I am not unfamiliar with guns. I grew up with especially the hunting variety. I remember driving in my grandpa's pickup truck with the gun rack right behind me as a kid. No seatbelt. Now, as an adult, I've gone a few times to a shooting range as my college boyfriend loved shooting, loved the feel of the weapon on his hands, the power, because guns are never just about guns. I didn't love it, but I still remember it, the feel, cold and heavier than you think. A little like holding the wheel of a car for the first time, which some people call it exhilarating. I couldn't stop thinking about the flash of one moment life, the next moment death, no do-overs, no take-backs. As a religious tradition, we have not come to consensus about violence. When or if ever harming another, especially taking another's life, is justified. In our history, you can find equal numbers of persuasive and impassioned pleas for pacifism and nonviolence, as there are assessments of the immorality of inaction in the face of broad acts of evil, especially towards the vulnerable and the marginalized. Many, like Theodore Parker, came to believe there is a time and a place to make the gun known and available and at the ready. In his case, there was that commitment for justice driving it, and there was a real threat, the danger for himself and those he housed. It was not imaginary. And also, it was not just a matter of self-defense. I mean, otherwise, he didn't need to bring it up in that May meeting with the other ministers, his colleagues, except that the majority of those colleagues had decided to cooperate with the Fugitive Slave Act. There's a pistol in my desk, loaded, ready for action. It's like a warning to them. Also a wish, maybe, that they would join him, a call out that they had not. There is a kind of embodied moral judgment in a gun, after all, or at least a willingness to make a judgment, good, evil, right, wrong, live, die, a judgment made real singularly, impulsively, irrevocably. Parker never had to use his gun. So it's hard to know if he would have been able, if he would have been willing, and not everyone is capable of that sudden, urgent movement to lift a gun, to pull the trigger, to hit the target, which is to say another person, to take the life, no take backs. This is a problem for our Unitarian Universalist faith, especially this no take backs. It is a problem especially for our Universalist faith, where, as the Reverend Carolyn Owen Toll said it, we say that no one, however criminal or addicted, incorrigible or ruthless, is beyond redemption. Guns stop the possibility of redemption, stop the path of reconciliation, stop the potential of grace breaking through. Guns make for clear endings sometime in the middle of everything. Just over a week ago marked the 10-year anniversary of that day in Tennessee, the Tennessee Valley UU congregation in Knoxville, the congregation where, coincidentally, Christopher, who played for us earlier, his father is the minister there. That morning, a man came in to where service was happening. It was actually a children's play, so all the kids were up in front. He brought with him a 12-gauge semi-automatic and a hatred for liberals and especially gay people. And here was a liberal church advocating for gay people. He opened fire. He killed one usher and one other member. The other members tackled him. Seven others were injured. Just like Columbine, so much came to an end that day. So much was lost. And also some new things were born. The congregation in Knoxville was the original inspiration that for the anthem that we're going to sing at the end of the service, what we is known today as answering the call of love. Their response after the shooting, especially their steadfast commitment to continue their advocacy for the GLBT community and their continued spirit of welcome and hospitality, despite all they'd been through, the ways they did not concede to fear, inspired then UUA President Bill Sinkford to say of them, "This is the best of who we are. This is the spirit of Unitarian Universalism." For a while, I confess, after Parkland, I was playing out the regular script, already anticipating the repeat. I mean, sometimes it's like it's just too much to take in. To fully let it in, the script can be a help. But it didn't take too many of those kinds of videos going through my feed, too many of seeing what was really going on before I realized that something else might be happening here. Something else might be happening here. Seeing in the, I mean, that is a high school student in front of thousands with, I can't do that. To stand there, straight-faced, tears flowing, and to hold that space as she did, there's something else going on there. I could have equally shown you the video of 11-year-old Naomi Wadler, who proclaimed she was there to represent the African-American girls and women whose stories don't make the newspaper, the victims of gun violence, who are simply statistics. Or I could have brought here the youth who are a part of this congregation, those youth who helped with the walkouts here in Fort Collins that were just one of over 800 March for Our Lives events that happened across the country. Listening to these, any of these, bearing witness to this, you realize that there is a movement happening here that's not just about school shootings. It's not just about one demographic or another. It is a movement that is asking us to deal with this story of guns, the things that guns are about beyond just the guns, their place in our lives, our country, our stories, our identity. They are asking us because they know personally that a gun is never just about a gun. It is about families and children and race and gender and economics and poverty. It is always still about power. who thinks they have it, who wants it, who thinks they're vulnerable, who doesn't want to feel vulnerable. And so here is my bold proclamation for Unitarian Universalism. Kids are greater than guns. Which, of course, I mean their lives matter more than guns, and we should do everything possible to live out that value, the value of the inherent worth and dignity of every single person, all ages. And maybe we could start by studying and learning and applying the lessons of what would really be effective in reducing gun violence. It would start by refunding the study that was defunded because we aren't even allowed to learn what would be effective in reducing gun violence. But that is not all I mean by kids are greater than guns. I mean even more, our children and youth are more powerful than guns and the gun lobby. They have the capacity to change the role of guns as they relate to the idea of being America, the idea of America itself. And as evidence, I offer the story that broke in the last couple days about the NRA claiming financial struggles. And they specifically name the boycotts that those students organized after Parkland. This is, after all, the generation born in the wake of 9/11. 9/11, that was 17 years ago, right? So they're turning 17 this year, which also means that these students, these kids today, they're not going to be kids for much longer, but voters. This is the generation, after all, where white people will be in 2 years. The minority. This is the generation capable of changing the American idea. In our church, we say often that each person has a piece of the truth and that truth continues to be revealed, which is another way of saying the story isn't over. We've been playing out this script over and over, but something new is still being written. And it is our job, all of ours, to listen to this new story, to mentor these students, these children and youth, but also to follow them, to show up where they say to follow up, show up, to pay attention to the issues that they're raising, to be okay with the way that they're organizing that's not going to be the same way that other generations have organized, to follow their lead and to believe and to help them believe that they can lead us into the future that we have not yet been able to deliver for them, but they are nonetheless prepared to seize. May it be so, and amen.